Hello, everybody. I am John Allen, the editor of Crux, and your host here on Last Week in the Church. This, of course, is the show where we review the major Vatican and global church headlines of the past week. And all I can say to you folks is, wow, what a week, huh? We had a full-blown, honest-to-God, bigger-than-life papal health scare this week as Pope Francis spent 3 nights in Rome's Gemelli Hospital to treat what the Vatican described to us anyway as a bout of bronchitis, presumably related to an infection brought on by breathing difficulties the pontiff was experiencing. Now, there is an inexorable, immutable, absolutely unavoidable metaphysical law of the universe that says that whenever there is a papal health scare, there will be a spin cycle of competing interpretations as fans of the Pope will want to tell you there is nothing to see here. Critics will want to say the end is near. On this show, we will try to separate reality from overreaction. Now, even if there hadn't been a papal health scare this week, however, it still would have been a big week on the Vatican beat. We had, first, a reformer resigns, if not the leading reform voice in the church's fight against sexual abuse has stepped down from the Pope's own hand-picked panel to advise him on the fight against sexual abuse. German Jesuit Father Hans Ollner has moved on. We will try to unpack what's going on there. Then there was disowning a doctorate. In response to popular demand, particularly from indigenous groups in the New World, the Vatican has formally disowned, if not quite rescinded, something called the Doctrine of Discovery, used to justify the brutal colonization of the New World. Again, we will explain what's going on there. And then finally, on the not quite so significant, but nevertheless interesting and borderline amusing front, we have an atheist on the Pope. Italy's premier atheist delivers his verdict on Pope Francis. I think you'll be interested in the conclusions he reaches. All that and more is waiting for you on this week's show after a very short break, so please stick around. Well, hello again, everybody. Happy Tuesday to you. Happy Tuesday, April 4th, 2023. Happy Holy Week. As we enter the most sacred period on the Christian calendar, I want to wish everybody out there a very happy Holy Week, a very happy Easter, because, of course, we won't talk to you again until not only after Easter, but after what the Italians call Pasquetta, the Little Easter, which is the holiday they celebrate on Easter Monday. In Italy, they say Easter is for your family. Okay, what you do on Easter is you go to Mass, and then you go to this huge lunch with everybody you are even vaguely related to. But Pasquetta, the day after, Easter Monday, that is for your friends. Most Italians go out of town, into the woods, or at the beach someplace, have a big barbecue. So let me take this chance to say both Buona Pasqua e Buona Pasquetta to everybody who is watching. All right, we begin this week with what was unquestionably the big Vatican story of the past 7 days, and that, of course, developments on the papal health front. So let me set the scene for you. On Wednesday, I had been asked to be part of a panel addressing a visiting delegation from the American Jewish Committee, and one of the questions that these people raised was about the Pope's health. I very dogmatically and confidently said, hey, Pope Francis is fine. Yeah, he's 86, but he is good to go, folks. He's going to be here through the two synods, that is the Synod of Bishops this fall and next fall, and the Jubilee of 2025. So, you know, calm down, nothing to see here. My wife and I then, after a very pleasant lunch with this group, went home, and an hour later, we got a bulletin from the Vatican announcing that the Pope was in Rome's Gemelli Hospital for what, at that point, they were describing as previously planned tests. Okay, now that claim to, you know, the attempt to suggest that this was a kind of routine thing that was not related to any emergency, it didn't really last very long. Already by Wednesday night and certainly Thursday morning, it was being reported in the Italian press that actually the Pope had shown up in the Gemelli in an ambulance, which is not what you do for routine tests. I had a routine test last week. I took a cab. Okay, you don't call an ambulance for that. And that he had been experiencing breathing difficulties, which was why he was in the hospital and why they decided to keep him. It later emerged that those breathing difficulties amounted to a case of bronchitis related to some kind of infection. The Pope was administered fluids and antibiotics through an IV intravenously, according to the Vatican, responded very well to treatment. By Friday and Saturday, he was well enough to be eating pizza with the people who were taking care of him. He visited a pediatric ward in the hospital to visit sick kids, also to baptize an infant who happened to be there with his parents for a checkup. And by Saturday morning, he was dismissed and headed back to the Vatican. Before he did that, he stood outside the Gemelli Hospital for an impromptu press conference where he seemed in very good form. By the way, huge last week in the church shout out and major props to our friend and colleague Delia Gallagher of CNN, who was on hand there at the Gemelli and basically conducted that off the cuff press conference with Pope Francis. Well done, Delia. Buon lavoro. In any event, and then, of course, Pope Francis came back to the Vatican, did another little interview with Rai, the Italian TV network, before he went in, resumed his normal schedule. He actually had an audience on Saturday with Canadian Cardinal Mark Ouellette, head of the Vatican's Dicastery for Bishops. And then on Saturday, of course, he presided over the traditional Palm Sunday liturgy, delivered his homily as usual, spent a good long time after the Mass in the Popemobile doing a swing through St. Peter's Square and down the Via della Conciliazione to greet the estimated 60,000 people who were on hand for the liturgy. All right. Now, here are the facts as we know them. Pope Francis is an 86-year-old man who, as a young man, had part of one lung removed after a severe bout of pneumonia. Later on in life, we know he has struggles with sciatica, a very painful nerve condition that sort of begins in the lower back and radiates down through the legs. This, of late, has constricted him to use a wheelchair or a cane in most of his public appearances. We know that 2 summers ago, he had a major surgery to remove part of his colon. He actually went to the Gemelli Hospital on that occasion on July 4th, America's Independence Day. My wife and I remember that because we were having a big July 4th party on our terrace, and virtually our entire crowd was composed of journalists who disappeared the instant it was announced that the Pope was in the hospital. And, you know, we also know that he had a minor outpatient surgery, basically, to treat a case of cataracts not long ago. So, how concerned should we be about Pope Francis's health? Well, here's what I would say. When you are 86, when you have the health history that I just ticked off, it is not that unusual to occasionally experience either respiratory difficulties or the racing of one's heart. If you are particularly fatigued or you have caught some kind of minor cold or infection. And so, in itself, the fact that the Pope had to be taken to the Gemelli and that he spent 3 nights there, it does not in itself mean that his life is at risk or that we are at a kind of fin de regime moment with regard to the Francis papacy. On the other hand, it also has to be said that with an 86-year-old with the health history I just ticked off, the dividing line between basically fine and in real trouble can be very thin. So, for now, I think the takeaway is the Pope remains good to go. Certainly the man we saw on Palm Sunday does not look like someone who is at death's door. On the other hand, you know, there are no guarantees in life. We will just have to wait and see. What I can guarantee you is that already in what is going to gather steam as we go forward is, as I described at the top of the show, a competing cycle of spin, where on the one side, there will be some naysayers and prophets of doom who will tell you that Pope Francis has now been, his papacy anyway, has been fatally weakened by all this. In the Italian press over the weekend was a piece by veteran Italian journalist Massimo Franco proclaiming that the Pope came out of the hospital significantly weakened and that a shadow conclave to determine the succession is now already underway. On the other side will be supporters and sycophants of the Pope who will insist that this all means absolutely nothing and that he is practically immortal. And that to suggest otherwise is a great act of disrespect and impiety. Look, both of those reactions are overblown. You know, as far as the Shadow Conclave goes, you don't need a papal hell scare for that. It's been underway since Amoris Laetitia in 2016, which hardened the battle lines in the Catholic Church and created this atmosphere on the Catholic right that said this just isn't our Pope. They've been talking ever since about what might happen next. Is this going to encourage them? Well, maybe, but I don't see any signs they were ever particularly discouraged. You know, and as far as the Pope being, you know, basically invulnerable, well, you know, this hospitalization also punctures that myth too, doesn't it? I mean, what it tells us is that we've got an octogenarian who seems possessed of an enormous reservoir of energy, but time and the tides stop for no one. The one thing I think I would add to all of this is simply that although I think the Pope comes out of this, if anything, strengthened, I mean, his performance outside the Gemelli, not just his little exchange with journalists, but signing the cast of an Italian kid who had been in the Gemelli with a broken arm, and then comforting a couple that had just lost their child in the Gemelli with this obviously moving pastoral moment. I mean, if anything, I think he comes out in a stronger position. You know who doesn't come out in a stronger position? I would say the Vatican's communications operation, because this was a disaster from start to finish. Trying to claim that this was a previously planned checkup, you know, that the credibility of that evaporated like dew in a summer sun. I mean, it was just gone. And what they need to do is that they need to give us access to the doctors and the medical team treating the Pope. You know, the fact that all of our information about his condition comes from the Vatican's paid spokesperson. Listen, Matteo Bruni is a personal friend of mine. I have enormous respect for the guy, but he does not have a medical degree. If you want me to take seriously someone standing up and pronouncing about somebody else's medical condition, I would like them to have some kind of medical training. I would like them to be involved in the treatment of that patient. You know, we got medical bulletins from the doctors and the John Pauliers. This is not rocket science. It can be done, and it can be done reasonably easily. So, memo to spinmeisters out there, this might be something to consider going forward. All right, off the papal health front, let us come to the reformer who resigned. So, anybody who has been paying attention to the child sexual abuse scandals in the Catholic Church knows the name of German Jesuit Father Hans Zollner. Father Zollner was the founder of the Center for Child Protection, which was originally created in Munich as a response to the explosion of the sex abuse scandals in Germany. It was then transferred to Rome to take up a residency at Rome's Jesuit-run Gregorian University, where it quickly became one of the leading sort of nerve centers in the church for thinking and programming related to the fight against sexual abuse. Father Zollner was the driving force behind Pope Francis's unprecedented 2019 summit involving presidents of all the bishops' conference in the world to talk about the fight against sexual abuse. He has been a member since the beginning of the Pope's own Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors, which was intended by Pope Francis when he launched it in 2014 to be sort of the tip of the spear in terms of the church's reform effort. So Zollner is one of two or three figures in the Catholic Church whose credentials as a reformer, as a man who cares deeply about the protection of children and vulnerable adults, is just utterly beyond question. He's up there with like Archbishop Charles Chaclun of Malta as one of the kind of informal saints of this effort. And so, when it was announced this week by Father Zollner that he was leaving the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors, it kind of set off shockwaves. What really set off shockwaves was the way this news was announced. Because what we first got was a statement from Cardinal Sean O'Malley of Boston, who, again, since the beginning, has been the president of that Pontifical Commission, announcing that Zollner was leaving, thanking him for his service, and saying he was leaving because he had just accepted a new position with the Diocese of Rome as a consultant on sexual abuse issues. And that was that. I mean, in other words, it seemed all very tranquil and sort of agreed upon. Just moments later, we got a separate statement from Zöllner saying he was leaving because he had issues with the Pontifical Commission in terms of transparency, financial accountability, administration, you know, all kinds of internal problems, and also its relationship with the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is the Vatican department where Francis had located the commission as part of his overall Vatican reform. And so O'Malley had attempted to put a pleasant face on this. Zöllner basically blew that up with his own statement, which then prompted O'Malley later in the day to issue a revised statement saying he had been surprised and troubled by Father Zöllner's statements and said he strongly disagreed with them. So, you know, what is going on here? Well, I think for the most part, you have to take Zöllner at face value. This is somebody who has dedicated his life to the fight against sexual abuse, particularly against sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. I mean, in the last 10 years, I would dare say there is no one on the planet who has logged more frequent flyer miles traveling the world to present seminars and workshops and assemblies and, you know, training sessions for Catholic outfits, for bishops' conferences, for chanceries, for dioceses, for religious orders, for Catholic organizations, to try to gear them up in the fight to create a safe environment for children. Hans Zöllner has earned the right to speak his piece. And so when he says he is troubled by how money is handled by the Pontifical Commission, how decisions are made and what the basis for them is, how personnel are handled, and about the relationship with the other powers that be at the Vatican, I think you have to take all that seriously. I would simply add that there is also a kind of institutional interests dimension to all of this, because that Center for Child Protection that I told you about has sort of transmogrified under Zöllner's leadership into a bigger and broader Institute for Anthropology, which he leads at the Gregorian University, and he has the entirely understandable and laudable ambition that that institute would become kind of the primary beachhead for reform efforts on sexual abuse. Now, the thing of it is, that's the same role that the commission, the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors, wants to have. So there is a kind of built-in, you know, and a rivalry maybe is too strong a word, but just, you know, both organizations are scrambling after the same funding and the same personnel, I would put it that way. So there is a kind of built-in tension. And one way that some in the Vatican anyway may be tempted to see Zöllner's departure is that it is not only about issues having to do with the internal operations of the commission, but it is also about Zöllner wanting to boost the stock of his own institute. Because the thing is, on the Pontifical Commission, Zöllner is a member, but he's not the guy in charge. You know, with his own institute, he definitely is. We will obviously follow the evolution of this story. One thing I think you can guarantee is that Hans Zöllner may have exited the Pontifical Commission. He has not exited the fight to create a safe environment for children and vulnerable adults in the Catholic Church. He will very much continue to be part of the scene. All right, we move to disowning a doctrine. So when Pope Francis went to Canada last summer, it was understood to be a journey of penance. It followed revelations about horrible abuses committed against Indigenous children at church-run residential schools in Canada. And so this was Francis's opportunity, if you like, to reach out to those Indigenous communities and apologize for the ways in which they had been let down or betrayed by the Catholic Church and other institutions. One of the key demands made by members of the Indigenous communities in Canada and elsewhere was that the Catholic Church formally rescind and renounce what is known as the Doctrine of Discovery. This is a doctrine associated with a series of papal bulls that came out in the 15th century and that later became the basis for various legal rulings in Western nations that gave legal cover to the colonization of the New World, which often meant the destruction of indigenous cultures, in some cases, almost the enslavement of indigenous persons, you know, the rape of their natural resources and so forth and so on. So finally, the Vatican responded to that demand. A joint statement from the Vatican's Dicastery for Education and Culture and also for Promoting Integral Human Development, which was released this week, basically said, we disown this doctrine of discovery. You know, the brutal suppression of the indigenous persons in the New World was a huge mistake. It was very, very bad. But they said this was never actually a doctrine of the Catholic Church. They said these papal bulls have sometimes been used to justify it. They may have had limitations in perspective, but they were never formally part of the faith of the Catholic Church, that this doctrine of discovery was actually a political and legal concept for which the Catholic Church doesn't have responsibility. So basically, they disowned the doctrine. They didn't rescind it because the argument was it's not ours to rescind. It was never part of the Catholic faith. Now, initial reaction to all of this was, I would say, positive to mixed. Many spokespersons for indigenous communities welcomed the Vatican's clear renunciation of the idea that it was okay to simply swoop in and destroy indigenous peoples and cultures. On the other hand, some of them said it didn't go far enough. I think the interesting unanswered question here is, will there be a theological follow-up to this? Because bear in mind, what these two Vatican dicasteries were commenting on was very much a political and social concept. They deliberately didn't want to get into a theological conversation. That's why the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith was not one of the signatories to this document. But there is a theological conversation to be had, because what some spokespersons for indigenous groups will argue is that as long as Christianity claims to be the ultimate truth about human destiny, as long as Christianity remains a missionary religion, wanting to convert people to the Christian message, that it will inevitably have a pretense of superiority to other religions, including indigenous religious traditions. And they would argue that Christianity needs to surrender, needs to forego, needs to renounce not merely the political doctrine of discovery, but the religious and theological doctrine of, well, basically the Great Commission, Christ's final command on earth to go forth and make disciples of all the nations. Now, that is a much stickier wicket for the Vatican to deal with. In the 90s, there was this whole debate over, theological debate in the church over religious pluralism. A number of theologians were investigated and censured. Teaching documents, especially Dominus Iesus in 2000, were put out. Right now, it does not look as if there's much appetite in the Vatican to revisit that conversation, but external pressures may drive them in that direction. We will see. Finally this week, I simply want to mention a very interesting interview that took place over the weekend on an Italian blog with a well-known Italian intellectual by the name of Pier Giorgio Odofredi. Odofredi is a mathematician and a scholar, an essayist. He is also known as perhaps Italy's most famous living atheist. He is the honorary president of the country's Union of Atheists and Rational Agnostics. But interestingly, he was a close personal friend of Pope Benedict XVI. The two did a book together after Odofredi had written Benedict about his book, Jesus of Nazareth. Benedict responded. Their correspondence became a book called Dear Pope, I'm Writing You, which came out in 2011. Now, over the weekend, Odofredi was interviewed about Pope Francis. Now, at one level, you may say, what does it really matter? You know, what an atheist with no ecclesiastical standing has to say. But here's one of the things I found interesting. At one point, the interviewer asked Odofredi, personally, what do you think of Pope Francis? And his answer was, first of all, I don't really understand him. I don't know what he's about. But he said he's a Jesuit, and so not being understood is sort of his mission in life, which was a little dig at the, you know, the famous, you know, obscurity and, you know, so forth of the Jesuits. The inscrutability, if you like, of the Jesuits. But he went on to say, for what I know, I don't really like Pope Francis very much. He seems an irascible and vindictive character who, you know, does not treat well people who disagree with him. And he cited the cases of German Cardinal Gerhard Müller, the Vatican's former prefect of the Congregation for the Faith, and German Archbishop Georg Gainswein, the former priest secretary to Pope Benedict XVI. Now, think of the irony of a left-leaning, secular, atheist intellectual having a bone to pick with a progressive pope because of his alleged mistreatment of two conservative prelates. I mean, it's kind of hilarious, but, you know, here's the serious point it makes. I think we in the media are obsessed with left v. right, right? The fight between liberals and conservatives, and we want to see everything in those terms. But Oda Fraidy is a good example that there are other ways of seeing popes. I think at the end of the day, what's clear from this interview is that Oda Fraidy, he may have had a truckload of disagreements with Benedict XVI, but at the end of the day, he saw him as a fellow intellectual, a fellow egghead, and they could connect on that level, and he liked him. Now, Francis is not an egghead. He is closer to the street than he is to, you know, the graduate seminar room, and that just, I think, is not to Oda Fraidy's taste. In other words, it is a reminder that the way people will react to popes is as diverse as the human family is. And it may not really have anything to do with the substantive merits of one pope or another. It may just have to do with the lens through which a particular person is doing the looking. That's probably a lesson worth remembering. All right, that is our show for this week. You can find, as ever, full coverage of all these stories on the Crux site. That is cruxnow.com. One more time, cruxnow.com. Say it again. And let me encourage you, while you are on the site, if you are inclined and have the means, if you could just make a quick donation to support the work of Crux. We have a little handy-dandy window there you can click. It's all nice and easy. It doesn't have to be very much. Maybe what you would spend on streaming a movie this month. But whatever it is, we would be deeply appreciative because we rely on the support of viewers and readers such as yourself in order to keep the lights on. We will be back here next week, same bat time, same bat channel. In the meantime, have a fantastic and blessed Holy Week. Stay safe, stay healthy. We will talk to you very soon.